Joining us today on the summit is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Mr. Kennedy, welcome and thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Your work and your background, Mr. Kennedy, you really need no introduction. Obviously, our audience is going to be familiar with you. You're a member of America's leading family, and you're not afraid of rejection. You're not afraid to rock the boat, especially for children's health and their rights, and you're willing to speak truth to power. Before we dive into your perspective on 5G, I wanted to first ask you, was there a turning point in your life, or was it a gradual process, or perhaps it was genetic? What led you to this role that you currently have of being a freedom fighter and willing just to take a bold stand for what you feel is right?
Well, I got involved in the environmental issues when I was a very little kid. I loved the outdoors. I loved the rivers and streams and animals. And I was very involved with wildlife. And from when I was little, and I was conscious of pollution. This was back in the late 50s and early 60s. And there was, Washington, D.C. had cement plants that were belching up smoke, and the soot would come down and land on your clothes. And, at that time, there was a lot of air pollution. There were tens of thousands of people who died every year in our country. I was conscious of that we were losing species in 1963. I was deeply involved in hawks and falcons, training hawks from when I was a little kid. And the kind of iconic bird for me was the Eastern Adams peregrine falcon, which was the eastern version of the most spectacular predatory bird in the world. Mm-hmm. It was a salmon pink and a beautiful white coverlet on its ear, and there was a pair of them that used to nest on the old post office building in Washington, D.C. And whenever I'd go visit my father, who was the attorney general, or my uncle in the White House, I would look forward to those trips because I could look down Pennsylvania Avenue to the post office building, and I could see these birds up there, and they're the fastest birds in the world. They flew 240 miles an hour, and I could watch them come down Pennsylvania Avenue at these extraordinary speeds and pick pigeons out of the air right in front of the White House, 50 or 60 feet above the White House. And for me, seeing a sight like that was more exciting than visiting my uncle at the White House. But that bird went extinct from DDT in 1963, the same year that my uncle was killed. I couldn't swim in the Charles or the Potomac or the Hudson when I was growing up because of the pollution. I remember the Cuyahoga River burning in 69. I remember the Santa Barbara oil spill, and I remember when Lake Erie, which was the biggest fishery, half the fish in the Great Lakes came out of Lake Erie, and when it was declared dead. Mm-hmm. And that drove 20 million Americans out of the street in 1970. I was 16 years old and went to New York City to demonstrate. Oh, I was involved with the environment from when I was little. When I was 8 years old, I wrote my uncle, the president, a letter and asked him if I could come talk to him about pollution in the White House. And I went, he invited me there, and I spent time with him in the Oval Office. And then he arranged for me to meet with Rachel Carson, who came to our house at Hickory Hill, and who he was actually defending at that time from the attacks by Monsanto and by his own USDA, by the Department of Agriculture, and also with his Secretary of the Interior. I was always involved in that. When I became an attorney, I went to work for fishermen on the Hudson, suing polluters, and helped build the Waterkeeper Alliance, which is now 350. Waterkeepers in 44 countries with the biggest water protection group in the world. I got dragged kicking and screaming into the vaccine issue. I was I was litigating at that time on behalf of various waterkeepers in the United States and Canada against about, I think, 38 coal-burning power plants and cement kilns across North America, mainly for discharging mercury. That's what we were targeted on. The FDA had just done a survey that found that 100% of freshwater fish in the United States were contaminated with dangerous levels of mercury. And, you know, most of that was coming from coal-burning power plants. I was going around the country talking about those lawsuits. And wherever I went, these women would sit in the front row and they'd come up to me afterward. And they were very presentable. They were professionals, most of them. They were pharmacists and doctors and lawyers and one of them was a psychiatrist named Sarah Bridges, and they kept handing me scientific studies and saying, if you're really sincere about your concern about mercury exposures to children, you should look at mercury in vaccines. And I avoided doing it for a long time. One of them actually came to my house in Cape Cod, and she was the mother of a child who had gotten autism from a vaccine and actually got an award from the vaccine court that recognized that his autism came from the vaccine. And she said, I'm not going to leave here until you read these studies. And she handed me a whole pile of scientific studies. And I'm accustomed to reading science. I wanted to be a scientist when I was a kid. That's one of the reasons I got into this racket. And I, you know, virtually all of my lawsuits, I've had hundreds of lawsuits, and virtually all of them included some kind of scientific controversy. So I'm comfortable reading science. And when I sat down and read it, I was immediately struck by the delta between what the scientific establishment, the medical establishment, were saying about vaccines and mercury and what the science actually said. And that kind of took me down a wormhole on this issue, and, you know, that it has ended up really kind of changing my career in many ways and taking me away from what I'd really like to be doing, which is to be suing water polluters and you know, working on energy issues and environmental issues, to spending a lot more time working on children's health. Mm-hmm.
So you founded the Children's Health Defense Organization because of your, like you were talking about how you became aware of vaccines and then the harmful side of them that really has been covered up. How does 5G fit into your initiative?
Children's Health addresses, you know, or advocates on behalf of children's health and particularly against toxic exposures, including pesticides like glyphosate. We've been very instrumental and involved in the Roundup cases, litigation, PFOAs, and then other kind of pesticides, fluoridation. And so 5G is, you know, something that it really fits in with all of the other things we're doing, because it's another, you know, our children today are walking around or swimming around in a toxic soup. And there's a lot of inflammation and a reaction that has synergistic effects that's coming from all kinds of different stresses. And 5G may be an aggravating factor in all of those things. You know, electromagnetic waves, we know, impact children, and they impact fetuses and children more than they do adults. We know they cause immune activation, that they cause inflammation, that the World Health Organization has said they are probable carcinogens. Mm-hmm. And this is, we're talking about existing cell phones, for example, which are, I think, 2.4 megahertz or gigahertz, much less potent in terms of their capacity to disrupt genes and to disrupt the electric currents in our body. So, you know, we're deeply concerned, particularly because you have a captured agency here, you have FCC, which is a kind of the poster child for a captured agency of the very, you have a very powerful industry, multi-trillion-dollar telecommunications industry. You have a military involvement, which is, you know, which makes it a lot more difficult because, you know, then there are immunity issues. It's hard to sue them. It's hard to bring them under the discipline of democracy. There's immunity from litigation for, you know, for human health effects in certain contexts with this already. So, and you know, big data today is driving everything. And this is a, and there's so many powerful interests within society. I want to see this happen. The big tech people in Silicon Valley, like Elon Musk and Amazon, that are putting all these satellites up, the big telecommunications companies, the Pentagon, the CIA, and you know, and then all of the other stakeholders in, you know, building up our data. And there's imperatives include competing with the Chinese and the Russians and other people around the world. And, you know, and this is a system that can be weaponized. Military applications. And so it's being pushed through without much thought. I mean, a few months ago, the highest executives of the telecommunications companies went before the Senate. And they were asked, have you ever done any health studies on 5G? And they said, no. And they were asked, have you allocated money to do health studies? And they said, no. And that seems kind of crazy because we know that there are literally thousands and thousands of peer-reviewed publications that associate not only 5G, but 4G. With detrimental effects on fetal and newborn development, on detrimental effects on young children, on brain tumors, other cancers, DNA damage, altered gene expression, neurological effects, cognitive impairment, impaired sperm function and quality, altered metabolism, cardiovascular diseases, learning and memory deficits, and many, many other, and not only human beings, but also that 5G actually has the capacity to alter the entire ecosystem. Nobody has studied it. Nobody knows what it's going to do. And yet, somehow, you know, it has its own logic that it is pushing it through the political process without any kind of impediments or questioning. It's really insane. It's a huge nightmare global experiment with human beings and the ecosystem as guinea pigs.
Yeah, and we saw that the Belgian Minister of the Environment and Housing for Brussels said that exact thing. I don't want my people to be as guinea pigs. You can't put 5G in, right? So, but let's talk about the environment a little bit more, the environmental effects of 5G. In other words, the pollinators, the animals, the soil. I know that there's some studies there. What can you tell us from your perspective as an environmental legal expert on this side of the 5G question?
I'm not a scientist, so I don't really know, but I know there's a guy called Alan Chope who's a famous architect, and he's an environmental leader. He also has an apiary at his home in Millbrook, New York. He has a lot of hives there. And about 10 years ago, I was at his house, and he said, I want to show you something. And he took my cell phone, and he put his cell phone on top of a beehive, and he called his cell phone, which was on vibrate. And when his phone rang, all the bees came out of the hive, and even the queen came out. And I was like, holy cow, I've never seen anything like that. I've been around bees my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen anything like that before. It takes a lot to get the queen to come out of the hive. And I said to him,
why is it doing that? And he said, I don't know. So, and I don't know why, and I don't know if anybody knows, but it's disturbing. And the fact that, you know, that something that has even that kind of observed anecdotal effect that I've seen, the fact that we can, you know, that we're gonna allow 20,000 satellites to beam that down on all of us. You know, I was at Standing Rock during the, you know, the demonstrations against the pipeline, and I didn't get hit with that, although they had a, you know, they had a electronic wave weapon there, and they had sound weapons, which I was attacked with.
Wow.
And they had water, but other people there had been there when they had turned on the electro magnetic weapons, whatever they are, and they described them, and they said it felt like their skin was burning up and they just wanted to run away. And you know, to fill the, I honestly, the other thing is, these are going to be low-level satellites. They're in the ionosphere. We have no, that's a very, very fragile part of the, you know, of the physiological ecosystem of the planet. And we have no idea what it will do if we, you know, if we disrupt the ionosphere in that way. There's so many unanswered questions.
Yeah.
And the experiment is so vast and so huge. It's literally, there's no part of the planet where anybody will be able to go to escape this. I mean, one of the good things is that there are localities around the planet, as you pointed out, that are saying, we're not going to allow the antennas here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's wait and see what happens with them. Let's see some science on them first. So people are standing up, and they are, you know, in a number of communities that have stood up against them, they've won those battles. But it's a very, very powerful industry, and these are tiny pockets at this time. And they're going to be able to end run everybody if they put it in space.
No.
Not any choice.
Okay, so you helped to lead the charge against Monsanto for that first big lawsuit. So what, from your perspective, Bobby, on what you're seeing Monsanto and how they're very likely, you know, falling, first of all, do you think Monsanto's going down? And second of all, if you could relate it to what you see happening within big telecom, is that also on a long sort of timeline for them to go down? What, I mean, how do you see this big picture happening, first with Monsanto and then with the big telecom and 5G?
I've been involved in all three Monsanto cases.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose you can say it's analogous because it's a very powerful industry that has a captive agency.
Mm-hmm.
And that was able for, you know, for 40 years to collaborate with regulators, with captive regulators inside of that agency to evade doing safety science on their pesticide, on their herbicide. And that, you know,
when we were able to actually get into the agency and look at the documents, it became very clear that they had moles in the agency that were working for Monsanto and that were not working for the American people.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, we had the most widely used pesticide in human history that essentially is now ubiquitous in most of our food, our water, and our air. And it was a giant experiment on humanity and on the globe. And there's impacts clearly on pollinators and other species, and there's impacts on the microbiome, the macrobiome, on all of the systems that, you know, are survival systems for humanity. And they didn't care because they were making money and they lied about the science. And so, you know, this is an industry with even more at stake, with not just billions of dollars, but trillions of dollars at stake. And, you know, they're, this is an industry that has friends at the highest level in both Democratic and Republican Party and ruling political parties all over the planet. Well, it's going to be a very, very tough opponent to grapple with because politically they're so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's someone that, a lawyer in Tasmania in Australia that is part of this summit that I've interviewed, Raymond Broomhall. He's led the charge in there in Australia and Tasmania, and he's actually had the success and results of blocking 2,500 small cell 5G installations. So this is something that's very new. He blocked 1,600 from going in, and actually 900 of them, the carrier uninstalled after he initiated, with the support of the community, a criminal action, a criminal assault-based action using doctors' medical opinions for their individual patients. Now, I know this is the first time that you might be hearing of this, but just... you know, what's your initial take on this development in terms of either the results or the legal process? And perhaps you and I can, you know, after this conversation, keep the line of communication going. I'd love your input.
I think there's a lot of opportunities, legal opportunities to challenge 5G on a local basis. I mean, my worry is I think using U.S. laws like NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is a law that requires environmental impact statements, and then each state has an analogous statute, and there's a lot of opportunities to, because there's so little science, we you know, they cannot give us a cost-benefit analysis because they've never done one. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the science to do one. They're just trying to rush ahead and use political clout to force it through. And so I think there are opportunities to challenge them and to create local pockets where they're not able to get in and, you know, and do their business. The problem is if they put them up in space and then there's nowhere and no way to escape from them.
Mm. Now, there's a unique aspect of 5G and wireless infrastructure and devices because from everything that we've uncovered, the big insurance companies do not insure electromagnetic radiation producing devices or technologies or cell towers. It seems that they're self-insured. I know Lloyd's of London has refused it. Swiss Re, the large underwriter, has issued a statement basically saying 5G and electromagnetic radiation is in the highest risk long-term of, you know, their highest risk category. What are your thoughts on this, the insurance side of things?
Well, you know, the insurance industry is the ultimate arbiter of risk. So, you know, these aren't hippies and tie-dyed, you know, who are saying, oh, this is a new technology that is too risky. And, you know, these are guys in suits from Wall Street and Fleet Street who are saying, this technology, we've looked at it, and we, if there was a way for us to make money insuring it, we would figure out how to do it. But it is so risky that any money we make, we can lose, you know, 10 or 20 times as much. We're not going to do it. And, you know, they did the same thing with the nuclear industry. The nuclear industry can't be insured. And so the nuclear industry went to Congress in a sleazy legislative maneuver in the middle of the night, passed the Price-Anderson Act, which essentially relieves nuclear power plants of liability, of the utilities that own them, of liability for radiation damage if they do have a leak or if they have an accident. So they're uninsured, and but Congress gave them a way to, you know, to get financing. But I don't, you know, I would agree that if you can sue them, unless they can figure out a way to do what the vaccine industry did, which is to get immunity from liability, I don't see, you know, I think they're going to get sued and they're going to have to pay a lot of money. But, you know, it will be, we live in a scary world right now because there are big industries like Nuke and like the vaccine industry that have been able to purchase Congress that gave them immunity from the injuries that they caused to human beings. And we'll have to see whether this industry is capable of doing that.
Now you mentioned, you're talking about legal immunity. You mentioned near the start of our conversation that that the way that you mentioned it, Bobby, seemed to indicate there might be ways through that, even in the vaccine side of things, so that they're not as immune as people perhaps perceive them to be. And also with the 1996 Telecommunications Act, Section 704, as you know, says that local governments can't refuse cell tower siting on the basis of environmental grounds. So that also is now coming into light, like people realizing that that perhaps isn't as ironclad of a immunity grantor than we led to believe, as we've been led to believe. What are your thoughts on either, if it's the vaccine side of things and the vaccine manufacturers, or the 5G telecom regulators and carrier providers?
I'm not sure what your question is.
My question is this. Is do they actually have full legal immunity, or is it just the perception?
I mean, they certainly have a limited immunity if you're trying to block, if a locality is trying to block them. A locality can't pass a law. Your local town cannot pass a law banning cell towers because on account of the risk that they pose to human health. But I'm not sure how much reach beyond that law has. If you, does that mean if you, does that mean that you can't sue them under NEPA and force them to do a environmental impact statement that discloses their health impacts? I don't think so. I think they still have to do that. I think we need to organize a resistance to it, and we need to get the lawyers fully engaged. We need to start probing the fortress walls for weaknesses, legal weaknesses, and do what we do, and with every, would use all the tools of advocacy, what Martin Luther King call the tools of advocacy, which is agitation, legislation, litigation, and I would add innovation. So all of those things are, we're going to have to summon the resistance and build a resistance around those kind of campaigns. Mm-hmm.
How important is it that we educate and inform and hold accountable our elected officials?
And the public.
Yeah.
People have no idea that this is happening. People, I think, are completely unconscious of it. And I think the industry likes that because nobody's asking questions. The public needs, we need to do a lot more about educating the public and educating public officials and getting some really good allies in Congress who are asking the right questions and who are calling, subpoenaing witnesses and having hearings so that the public understands this.
When I was talking with former Michigan Senator Patrick Kolbeck, he was saying that he was giving a little bit of insight into, elected officials, their mindsets, what their, how you actually create change at that level. Something that he told me was that 20% of elected officials are on one side, locked in, and not their perspective is not changeable. 20% on the other side, 60% are more malleable. But pretty much everyone is subject to tremendous lobbying, right? What can you tell us? Does that line up, first of all, with your perspective? Or what can you tell us about how really to make inroads and get champions and have influence within the realm of elected officials across the country and around the world?
It's harder and harder because so much of it is money-driven. And the telecommunications are like the oil industry and the pharmaceutical industry. They put a lot of money into lobbying on Capitol Hill. So they already own a lot of congresspeople. They own a lot of lobby shops. They have hundreds of lobbyists. And there are no public organizations at this point with the presence on Capitol Hill. So there are zero lobbyists against this on Capitol Hill, and there are hundreds and hundreds of lobbyists for it. So that's a deficit we're going to have to cure, that we're going to have to remedy. And then the presence of people is the other thing. I mean, politics is driven by two things: democratic politics, democracy. Democratic politics, small d democratic politics. One is money and the other is intensity. And I think the intensity will come from our side. But they have the money and they also have these very, very powerful allies, that exercise an unseen hand in this process. The intelligence apparatus and the military apparatus that is looking at this as a, as a national security issue. And, of course, there's more and more focus on cyber warfare. And, there's going to be an imperative that says we don't want to lose the cyber warfare battle to the Chinese. And look what they're doing. We know that they're doing this. We need to stay ahead of them. So I think all of those things are going to be, all of those imperatives will have their ambassadors who are whispering into ears on Capitol Hill and telling them not to listen to our side and not to listen to the human health aspects, and we're going to have to find our own champions.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about informed consent, the principle of it, why it's important for ourselves and our children, future generations going forward.
Well, informed consent is most of us agree that it's a fundamental right or interventions that are going to impact our health. It really gained a lot of traction after World War II when, human beings were subject in concentration camps and elsewhere to unwanted experimentation, medical interventions, and essentially human experimentation. And the Nuremberg Accords and the Helsinki Agreements and many, many other international ethical treaties and proclamations recognize the Syracuse Agreement, which is the sort of ethical constitution of the United Nations and one of the primary human rights declarations all recognize that informed consent prior to interventions that might affect human health is a human rights, is an essential fundamental human right. And, if you put all these things in space with no information. Without information, you can't have a consent. And right now, nobody has this information. And they, the people who are putting it up in space admit that. They were specifically asked by the Senate, have you done any studies to test if this is safe? There is no data that would indicate that it's safe. There's only propaganda, but there is no data. There are no data. And there are a lot of studies that indicate it is not safe.
I believe that Americans deserve to know what the health effects are, not to prejudge what scientific studies may show. And they deserve also a commitment to do the research on outstanding questions. So my question for you, particularly Mr. Gillen and Mr. Perry, how much money has the industry committed to supporting additional independent research? I stress independent research. Is that independent research ongoing? Has any been completed? Where can consumers look for it? and we're talking about research on the biological effects of this new technology.
There are no industry back studies to my knowledge right now. Happy to visit with you as to what opportunities you think there needs to be more studies, and we're always for more science. We also rely on what the scientists tell us.
So essentially, the answer to my question, how much money? Zero.
I can certainly follow up with you, Senator. To my knowledge, there's no active studies being backed by industry today.
Anybody else know of industry commitments to back research, fund it, support it, to ascertain scientifically the health effect?
No, I'm not aware of any.
So there really is no research ongoing. We're kind of flying blind here, so far as health and safety is concerned. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With regard to whether it's 5G, you know, deploying it without any safety studies, or whether it's vaccines being mandated in the face of a lot of obvious risk once you look into the science, how is it that, you know, that these agendas continue against informed consent? And really, what are the implications of, if we don't draw a line now, you know, to protect ourselves and our children, you know, from these invasive technologies, you know, what are the implications going forward? Who really owns our bodies? Who really owns the bodies of our children if we kind of allow this trend to continue?
Those are all those questions are tied up in the, you know, in the essential question, which is, can we maintain the integrity of our democracy? Or is our democracy, because of all the money in politics now, is it, you know, are all of our rights going to be subverted and made secondary to corporate profit taking? And that's what we're seeing today. You know, you're seeing a domination of the political process by this kind of corporate kleptocracy. And all of human behavior is now subject to regulation in a way where the primary priority seems to be the profits of these corporations, and that, you know, all of us are subject to being commoditized. The landscapes are being commoditized. Our children are being commoditized, and you know, it's a shocking evolution of American democracy from its highest ideals, which are human dignity, independence, human freedom, the right to choose. And let's listen to what human beings say, and, you know, and we're dealing with a Congress now that is actively urging big tech companies to censor questions or critical information about pharmaceutical products. And there, you know, there's 1,500 pharmaceutical lobbyists on Capitol Hill, and the other industries are going to do the same thing. They're going to censor bad information. You know, there was a law passed in Texas last month that makes it illegal, makes it a felony to participate in a demonstration against pipeline projects. We're reaching that point in our democracy where arguing with a corporation or criticizing a corporation is going to become a criminal act. And we already are there with the vaccines. Now, the vaccines are a profit-making drug, a $50 billion industry that are being mandated, forcibly imposed with coercion on American citizens against their will. And you know, and we have our political leaders who are telling these big tech companies, where everybody agrees they're far too powerful, that they should censor any criticism. They should censor photographs of children who have been, you know, injured by vaccines. They should abolish vaccine injuries by fiat, by simply declaring it doesn't exist and allowing nobody to talk about it. And it's a very, very dangerous place that we're going into. It's Kafkaesque. And but it paves the way for 5G, because that's what they're going to need. Because this is something that is bad for human beings, clearly. it's going to benefit, the military industrial complex. It is not going to benefit the average American. And yet they're going to try to force it on us because so many people are going to be making profits from it.
About censorship, I want to ask your perspective on what we're seeing, the censorship, particularly around, vaccine choice, vaccine safety and rights. So are they doing this, taking books, off Amazon and films off Amazon and now social media and you can't even have your say about simple facts. Are they doing this because they're afraid of something in terms of, I say they, I mean, the corporate complex, the pharmaceutical industry, or are they just doing it because they can?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry does not want to have a debate. I mean, I've been doing this for many years. The last time I was allowed to publish an editorial, I'm just talking about the mainstream papers like the New York Times, the LA Times, or the Chicago Sun-Times, or the San Francisco Chronicle, or the Boston Globe. None of those have ever let me write an editorial, ever. But for a while, Huffington Post was, and some of the other liberal blogs. But the last time I was allowed to write an editorial in the Huffington Post was in 2009. So that's a decade ago. So even these what's so-called liberal blogs, which are supposed to be the antidote to the corporate control of American society and democracy, have somehow been persuaded that they need to be part of this juggernaut of censorship. And now you have the social media, Facebook and Google, they have their own partnerships with the vaccine industry. Google is now a vaccine company. It has a partnership with GSK, with GlaxoSmithKline. I think a $600 million partnership where not only are they making vaccines together, but they are also, GSK has a contract to mine data for Google and to look at your health information and, your heart rate when you're holding your cell phone and what, Alexa or Siri, find out about you as you're living in your home, and to mine that data and then to develop drugs and vaccines, et cetera, and then, directly market them to you. So it's a frightening world we live in, and the pharmaceutical companies control hospitals, they control the medical schools, they control the journals, and now they control the social media. And of course they control the TV. Anybody who looks at an evening news show, I think now, I read the other day that the average evening news has 22 ads on it, and 17 of those are pharmaceutical companies. So, of those per advertising purchase dollars, $9 billion a year that they're putting into American media is purchasing content as well. And that's a bad thing for democracy, because democracy depends on an informed public.
Yeah. You mentioned big data. You're talking about all these connections behind the scenes. How do you think children would be impacted, Bobby, by what 5G would bring in terms of constant surveillance and data harvesting?
Well, I have seven kids, and I'm very frightened to think about the world that they're growing up in. Because I think everything that they do is, they're never going to be out of sight of some kind of surveillance system. It's scary. It's scary. It's scary to think about how you can maintain a democracy under those conditions.
I have so much respect for you because you have taken the bull by the horn, so to speak, and you're fighting for what's right. And everybody, watching this gets that. We're so grateful for you. What do we need to do to turn this thing around?
Well, I mean, on a large level, I think we need to get money out of politics. So we need to reverse the Citizens United case and return to where we were before, and restore the integrity of our democracy. On the smaller scale, everybody needs to become an activist. Everybody needs to become involved. You can't afford to sit at home anymore and, you know, and pretend this isn't happening, because it's real now and the bad guys are winning and we need to take back our democracy. And of course, what I would suggest to people is that they should join Children's Health Defense, follow me on Instagram, and get involved. I thank you.
Thank you. And I second that. Everybody watching this, there's a link on this page. Go click that. Go to Children's Health Defense website. Sign up for an email. Get involved. Mr. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., thank you so much for everything you're doing in the world and for the time that you've given us in coming on the summit today. On behalf of everyone watching, we really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Aaron. It's been really a pleasure.